Decentraland Podcast with David Amoyano.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the week of the Decentraland Podcast. So today, I am actually recording from my work office, from my day job, right around the corner from the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Decentraland never stops. Alex is in studio. We're going to do our opening segment. We're going to talk a little bit about Napoli. We're going to get into that Acerbi Bakayoko Kessi incident. I got a lot of thoughts on that. We're going to name our winners and losers of the Serie A weekend. We're going to cover Fiorentina with our good friend Chloe Beresford. There's been a lot going on there. We're going to get to our Twitter questions. We have a bonus section of Twitter questions from our patrons. Thank you so much for your support there. And I'm very excited to close the podcast with a guest I've been wanting to have on for quite some time, one of my favorite journalists in Italy from Gazzetta dello Sport, Alex Frosio. I think you'll enjoy that. So we should have a great show for you today. But let's start at the top with our dear friend, producer, co-host of the show, Alex Goldberg. And Alex, on Thursday, we recorded right before Napoli faced Arsenal, and you had mentioned that Arsenal wasn't in a particularly good moment, so there was some positive momentum for Arsenal. Napoli got embarrassed, especially in the first half. They find themselves in a similar situation to Juve after the first leg against Atletico, having overcome a 2-0 deficit. We kind of a reverse jinxed Juve. I'm sure we didn't play a part, but I'm going to try to keep the tradition going. So let's go on the assumption Napoli are going to get eliminated by Arsenal later this week. Considering also they're so much further behind Juve than they were this time last year, do you think it would be a stretch to call Napoli's season a failure if they were to be eliminated later this week?
I do, David. I do think it would be a stretch because let's first look at the positives for Napoli. A lot of people, including myself, picked Inter to finish in second. And Napoli right now look like they will definitely finish in second, barring something very unexpected. And I understand, well, they're still a crap load of points behind Juventus, more than they were last season. But still, second place is second place. And their goal differential is +9 over Inter, and it's only 10 behind Juventus, so it's not like they've played a horrible product of football. You would hope, as a Napoli fan, that they could get further into the Europa League, especially at least the semifinals. But let's be real, second place in Serie A, quarterfinals at worst in the Europa League, and I don't think you could at all call the season a failure when there have been some positives, like a Fabian Ruiz. I think it's been, I know he was not great this past Thursday, but I think that is definitely a bonus for Napoli this season. They definitely have a midfielder for now and the future, a new piece to their foundation. Alex Murray, I think they can feel good about him. So I would have a hard time calling a season a failure if you're going to be second in your league, which is, by the way, where people projected you, or they projected you third. You're going to at least make the quarterfinals in Europa, and you acquired two players that are pretty young that have shown you good stuff this season and can definitely show you even better stuff in the future. So I understand where the question comes from. I totally do. But yeah, it would be a stretch for me to call it a failure. So David, that's my answer. What about you?
So I'm a bit ambivalent. I mean, one thing with Napoli is the expectations from the fans, their own fans, has clearly increased after last season, coming so close and, not winning. And, Sarri had obviously left an imprint there, but it's not like they replaced them with, like, say, an up-and-coming manager. They brought in Ancelotti. So I think there is still an expectation for a trophy. They're not out yet. And hopefully this will have the same impact that with Juve and Atletico. But on the assumption that they go out, I think it would be a disappointing season. Failure might be a bit of a stretch. I think if they are eliminated, we can chalk this up as a transition season for Napoli. Because in my mind, as you mentioned, at Fabian Ruiz and Mere, two young players, they paid a lot for their standards, Napoli, but their values are clearly already more than what they paid for, and they look like really strong building blocks for the future. Fabian Ruiz looks like he can be the new version of Hamsik. Mere looks like the best keeper Napoli has had, maybe even in my lifetime, and if you know me, that's a long time. Also, the way I see it, you know, we've had Milik exploding, and I feel in some ways we've had a transition away from some players that were key for Napoli before. We saw Hamsik leave. Callejon looks like they won't extend his contract. Insigne is not having a great season. Mertens kind of having a resurgence now. But the way I see it, you could make a case that Napoli's nucleus moving forward is going to be Mere, Koulibaly, Fabian Ruiz, Milik. And that's a very good base to begin with. So I think you might be right calling it failure, a stretch. Granted, the expectations are higher, but I think we'll look back as this as a transition year for the club. So, Alex, you've obviously followed Arsenal. You've watched the game. Tell me a little bit. Do you think it's in the cards for Napoli to make a comeback the way Juventus did against Atletico? Is there something in Arsenal that should give maybe Napoli fans some hope here?
Coming from a Chelsea fan, there's always something in Arsenal that should give the opposition some hope. But, okay, let's be realistic. Let's be serious. Arsenal play today, so depending on when you're listening to this, Arsenal have probably already played. But they play a very important Premier League match against Watford. And like I've been saying, Arsenal and every top six Premier League team right now have to care about the Premier League because City and Liverpool are fighting for the title and the other four are fighting for Champions League hopes. And they're also in Europe. So they really are caught in between two minds, if you will. So let's see how that game goes. If they win, fine. I mean, I don't necessarily think Arsenal are in any better position on Thursday, but maybe something negative could happen that could put them in worse position. And then, sure, David, they have the game against Napoli on Thursday, and it definitely hurt Napoli to not get an away goal. I mean, let's be real. That really hurts to go down 2-0, but also not get an away goal. But Arsenal then have a game just a couple days later on Sunday against Crystal Palace. And once again, they're going to need to also think about having a fresh fit lineup for that game because it's super, super important. So let's see what Unai Emery does. Does he take a little bit of a gamble with his lineup against Napoli, knowing that he's got a 2-0 lead on aggregate and all he needs is one away goal to really hurt Napoli's chances? And does he maybe prioritize and take a little bit of a risk and prioritize his lineup for the Premier League game just a couple days later? So I would say because of that, because of the fact that he does have to also think about the Premier League games and because Napoli are a good team. I mean, they're good enough to come back against an Arsenal. I do give Napoli a shot. I definitely do. They'll be at home, but that no away goal burns. So if I had to put a percentage on it, I'd give like Napoli a 35% chance coming back. And let's be real, they don't have Cristiano Ronaldo. So that always helps when you're trying to come back in the Champions League. So that's my answer. But David, let's transition here. You alluded to this at the top of the show, and I definitely saw a lot about this on Serie A Twitter. Tell me more about this incident that my boy Bakayoko and then Frank Kessie got into with Acerbi, and what's your take on all of it?
So never a dull moment in Serie A. Feels like almost every week we have a topic that's not really related to the games or even transfers. So, you know, look, for us that do content on Serie A, that's a good thing. So I'll tell you, my first reaction is, so to give some background, last week, Acerbi, who came up in Milan's youth system, was asked about facing Milan. And he said, we're going to San Siro to win. We're a stronger team, player by player. We are stronger than Milan. So my first reaction was like, okay, I get a player confident in his team. I can't say I've heard many times a player get so specific saying player by player, we are better. So let's start with that. Then we had Bakayoko, who's very engaged on social media. I'm surprised he hasn't made a video about you yet, Alex, or maybe he has and I've yet to see it. He responded saying, we'll see you on Saturday at the game. So they played Saturday. It was a very contested game, controversial calls with VAR. After the match, there was some shoving, some pushing, and nobody's talking about that, which is probably in some ways a bigger story. But what happened is that Acerbi, to try it as a peace sign to try to end the controversy, exchanged jerseys with Bakayoko. But then Bakayoko and Kessie took Acerbi's jersey as kind of a trophy or like a scalp, like in the Western days, to kind of show Milan fans, hey, this is the guy that was talking crap about us. Here's the jersey. And Musacchio and some other Milan players kind of stopped him. In their opinion, it was in poor taste. Gattuso was very critical after the match about it. And look, you know, that's another thing that I have to say off the top of my head. I don't think I've ever seen that happen in a match, but it really took on a life of its own. And we'll get into it a little bit more with the Twitter question. So my reaction was like, yeah, I mean, was Kessié and Bakayoko did childish? Yeah, they apologized for it. But I think, you know, in a way, it's kind of a shame that what we're not talking about is this was a huge win for Milan for the Champions League qualification. Like, they basically took Lazio out of contention, made a massive step forward. I think Gattuso deserves some credit. Nobody's talking about that, and nobody's talking about the shoving match after that. So I found that was kind of one of my main takeaways there. But again, never a dull moment in Serie A. And to wrap it up after, I have to say, Acerbi wrote a really nice tweet saying, you know what, let's just move on. And he tweeted a picture of him and Bakayoko hugging. There's been reports that Bakayoko and Acerbi talked on the phone after. So I kind of like Bakayoko. He's very human. You see a lot of his aspect. And I think they realized they were out of line. But I think it was a little bit too much. And to me, the sad part, it just takes away from more important storylines, like especially Milan's win there.
Oh, Bakayoko, you really keep things fresh. You really, really do. So that was obviously something from the weekend. But let's look even further into the weekend. We're going to do our normal Monday episode of Winners and Losers. So without further ado, who are winners and losers of episode 211 of the Calcioland podcast?
So Saturday we had Juve traveling to Ferrara with a squad of basically a lot of Primavera players, very few starters. But who scored as usual? Mozic Kane off a deflection. I think he did it on purpose, but the guy can score in every fashion. It feels like him scoring in a match is like inevitable as Meryl Streep getting nominated for Best Actress at the Oscars. So Kane, winner once again. Want to highlight Spal fans who applauded Kane strongly after he was subbed out. You know, I always like to say, like, Italy is very parochial, very different. Most of ultra groups tend to be right wing. I'd say that part of Italy tends to be more left wing, maybe a little bit more tolerant. And the reaction there, I whatever the political leaning, Spal fans deserve a lot of credit for applauding Kane, and also for Spal Floccari, who scored the game winner. He hadn't scored in a year. Huge 3 points for Spal, no doubt about it there. On the Milan-Lazio, strictly on the match itself, it's been so long that Milan got a penalty kick in a match that I had forgotten that Frank Kessié is kind of a specialist at penalty kicks, and that's kind of rare for a defensive midfielder. But he's really good on those. That was a huge penalty kick, a huge moment for Milan. So he's a winner. Another one, Peperina, who's been playing for Donnarumma, who's injured, although he looks ready to come back. He's played well, and he's played like the highest paid backup goalkeeper in Serie A. He's at least lived up to that. Then we had Roma, who had a big win. We had Zeko scoring his first goal at the Olimpico in over a year. They beat Udinese. Before Udinese played pretty well, but huge win for Roma. El Shaarawy had a fantastic assist. I think with Manolas, El Shaarawy has been Roma's best player this season. You could say De Rossi too, although he's been injured a lot. And then we had Mirante, who's been very good when playing for Roma. You have to wonder how much different the season would look for Roma had they just played Mirante over Olsen. Then we had the Saturday games. We had Koulibaly scoring a brace, his first brace in Serie A, relegating Chievo. Milik scored his 17th goal of the season. He's had no penalty kicks. So if you take away penalty kicks, only two players in Serie A have scored more goals than him, and that's Piontek and Zapata. And we're recording this before Atalanta faces Empoli, so maybe Zapata will add to his tally. So great season for Milik. We had Cagliari with a very impressive draw at Torino. Cragno, their goalkeeper, continues to be outstanding. To me, Mere gets a lot of hype, rightfully deserved. Mere has been excellent this season. Bacraño has been just as good. He's appeared in more matches. If I had to pick my Serie A goalkeeper of the season right now, it would be Craño. Just really outstanding. Had another great game against Torino. And as usual, Pavoletti scored off a header. We must have mentioned him in Winners and Losers a bunch of times for the same reason. Then we had Inter, who beat Frosinone. Nainggolan scored, so he's a winner. We've been critical of him, but that was a very important goal. We had Vecino sealing the goal in a stoppage time. And before, we had Perisic and Icardi kind of arguing a little bit in not a very strong way over who would take the penalty. Perisic converted. Icardi was the first one to congratulate him. There's definitely been some bad blood between the two, so I think that was kind of a good sign for Inter there. Then off the pitch, we want to give a shout-out to Torino defender De Silvestri, who just graduated university. I think he's one of only five or six current Serie A player with a university degree. A great guy, De Silvestri, has over 300 caps in Serie A, got a degree and business management. So shout out to him, one of the good guys in Serie A. Flip side, the losers. So we had Udinese and Genoa, who had losses in the relegation race. Also, I forgot to mention Sampdoria and the winners. They won the Derby della Lanterna. Quagliarella, another great game, not surprisingly. Genoa lost. Udinese lost to Roma. They're in pretty good shape in the race to avoid relegation, but they did got no points there. We had Montella, his first match back at Fiorentina, and we'll talk about him in a second with Chloe Beresford. Home draw to Bologna, definitely disappointing. Even more disappointing to me was Torino's home draw to Cagliari. I've been very bullish on Torino this season. I just don't think they get the credit they deserve. But at home, combined between Bologna and Cagliari, they only got 1 point. Had they done better, they'd still be in the mix for a Champions League spot. But you know what? Those games are really, really important. The Torino's had a lot of recriminations against the referees this season, but you also have to get out of your own way and just win these matches. Frosinone, also a tough loss. They're basically relegated at this point. And then the GOAT in a bad sense in the Lazio-Milan match was Durnisi, the backup left back who arrived from La Liga in the summer. He played for Lulic, caused the penalty, was an absolute disaster there. So those are our winners and losers. And someone who's always a winner is our great friend, Chloe Beresford. She's the first interview of the show. We wanted to get into some of the storylines around Fiorentina. So for the first interview of today's podcast, you guys know we like to cover all the teams, not just the ones at the very top. And Fiorentina has been in the headlines quite a bit in the past week for a lot of different storylines. And when it comes to Fiorentina, there's really no one better than our next guest, Chloe Beresdorf, who's been on the pod quite a few times. While she is an expert on Fiorentina, she also does a great work covering all of Serie A. You can read her on Football Index UK, the excellent Flow FC website. She also has had appearances on Five Live Sport, and she is a panelist on one of my favorite culture-related podcasts, and that's the Serie A Show with our friends John Solano and Nima Tavalli. So, Chloe, I know this isn't the best circumstances going on with Fiorentina, but we really appreciate you hopping on to give us your perspective on everything that's going on there.
Yeah, oh, that's no problem.
Okay, so let's start at the top, Chloe. I know there was a managerial change, which is the meat and potato of what I want to ask you about. But beyond that, I would say it's fair to say this has been a disappointing season for Fiorentina. Over the weekend and recently, there's been a lot of criticism in the city on the owners, the De La Valle brothers. So let me ask you very simply, do you find the criticism fair? And can you describe a little bit what are the main bones of contention with those criticizing them at the moment?
I think, obviously, at the weekend versus Bologna, there was a significant protest in that the fans in the Curva Fiesole associated with organized groups did not go into the stadium until half time. And while on the surface that seemed a little bit harsh because Fiorentina just made a managerial change and it, it, it would have been nice to have the fans there to welcome Montella back to the club. But it's more than just what's on the surface. The issues with the owners has been long-standing, long-running. And basically, you know, since they did save the club in 2002 when they came on board and saved the club from bankruptcy and all of that. But that is now a very long time ago. And the feeling is that they continue to use Fiorentina, the brand of Fiorentina and the city and, you know, all the tourism that comes into the city as a vehicle to promote their shoe business. And that they don't invest in the team significantly. They don't, you know, they've been proven several times to have basically made up stories and told lies about ex-managers. Cesare Prandelli came out in the media a couple of weeks ago and said that they made up a story about him wanting to go to Juventus because basically they wanted him out and he knew the fans wouldn't like that. So, you know, it's not just one person that's saying this about the Della Valleys, it's several ex-employees. And indeed, the current manager, Vincenzo Montella, he left because he'd finished fourth, three seasons in a row. And he reached the Europa League semi-final. He asked for a little bit more investment to take the team higher. And basically, they sacked him for that. And you know, these are the issues that they feel, the fans feel, that Fiorentina is a club with great potential. They have a brilliant stadium. They're always well supported. There's only one team in the city. They have all this tourism and all this potential. And they, the current owners are just letting the club stagnate. And for them, that, for them, they're so passionate and so dedicated, that is just not acceptable for them. So it does seem a little bit harsh what happened at the weekend, but there is a lot more to it than just what was on the surface.
Yeah, you know, from where I'm sitting, you know, it seems to me Fiorentina, you know, is kind of falling behind the likes of Atalanta, Torino, Sampdoria, is kind of being the overachieving mid-table team. So I can totally understand. It's interesting that you mentioned, I mean, Florence, they have just one team there. It is a lot of tourism. There's probably more that could be done with the team. So interesting perspective there. So now let's talk about the coaching changes. So let's start with Pioli. So the Frosinone match ended up being decisive for his tenure at Fiorentina. A lot happened during his time at the club, both on and off the pitch. So very simply, were you surprised that he was replaced this late into the season?
No, I wasn't surprised. I do have to say, on a football, a purely football level, I agree that it was time for him to go. I think that he, you know, there were obviously a lot of circumstances last year with the death of Davide Astori and, you know, everything that had happened during his reign at Fiorentina. But purely on the pitch, he seemed like he was completely out of ideas. It was the same old thing week after week, and all of the draws. It was just not good enough. I mean, I think it was a shame that they didn't give him to the end of the season in a way, because they obviously there's the second leg of the Coppa Italia semi-final to come, and it would have been nice for him to be able to see that through to its conclusion. So yeah, I agree that he, you know, it wasn't working with him, and he'd run out of steam, really. But what I don't agree with is the way that it was handled. They criticised the, in a public club statement, they criticised him on a human level, which I think, after the way, the amazing, incredible way that he handled the whole situation of his captain suddenly not waking up one morning, you know, it wasn't fair to him. He represented the club with, you know, at a time when he was personally must have been really in shock and grieving. He was brave enough to come out and speak to people. He consoled the players. And, you know, I don't think the Fiorentina fans can ever thank him enough for the way that he handled that. And, you know, he has been treated pretty badly. And I think that is just another thing that's angered the fans. And there was indeed a banner in the Curva Fiesole in support, saying uno di noi, one of us, for Pioli in the Curva Fiesole, just to give him that message that he will never be forgotten for what he's done for the club.
So now let's talk about Pioli's replacement. So we had Vincenzo Montella return. So let me ask you, obviously Montella's been at the club before. And, you know, when you look at what happened at Fiorentina afterward, maybe that era looks better now. So what do you remember mainly about Montella's first crack at being Fiorentina's manager?
Well, I actually think it was a really fun time under Montella. They had... Eduardo Machia is a sporting director who's Spanish and brought in a lot of Spanish-speaking players. We had players come in at the beginning with Montella, like Gonzalo Rodriguez and Borja Valero. And, you know, he created a really, really fun-to-watch team. There were some great nights. There were some great nights in Europe. You know, we Fiorentina beat Tottenham. I think in his second year in charge, there was the 4-3 defeat of Juventus. There were a lot of really, really good times. And whilst the results weren't massively consistent, you know, you can't argue with the fact that they finished in fourth place in all of his 3 years there. And that now would, at the time it was Europa League place, but that now would be Champions League football. And to think that we're now sitting in 10th position, that would be incredible if he could replicate that. And it really wasn't his fault that he had to leave. He reached the Europa League semi-final, and he said to the board, you know, we just need a bit more money. We just need to push on a little bit more. And, you know, that was obviously not the right thing to say. And they got rid of him. But, you know, I just think it was such a fun time, and I hope we can bring those times back again to Fiorentina, because the fans they really loved it.
Yeah. So again, I don't want to overreact to the first match against Bologna. He had just arrived, but what was your reaction to the news? Do you think this is a good move? You know, in Italy, there's a saying, la minestra riscaldata non è buona, so warmed up soup, you know, the second time around. Usually isn't so great. But, you know, when I look at what Montella did at Fiorentina, maybe this is a good thing. What's your outlook on what we can expect from him moving forward?
Well, a lot of people, first of all, I didn't expect him to come back. I was quite surprised when and the news was announced so very quickly after the news that Pioli had been sacked. It made me wonder if maybe they already had him lined up for the end of the season and just put him in a bit quicker. I thought the relationship with the Della Valleys had been completely broken when he left. But I guess now that Fiorentina are sort of in mid-table in Serie A, that the issues that he had before were probably not present. You know, he's not asking for more money to get into third place, because Fiorentina aren't anywhere near that. So he probably thinks that, you know, he's not going to run into the same problems, at least not for a while anyway. And from his point of view, I think he's had a couple of failed stints, like at Sevilla and AC Milan. And I think it gives him a chance to get his reputation back in a place that's familiar to him. So in that way, it makes sense. And a lot of people on Twitter, like Milan fans, have said to me, oh, you know, you must be devastated that Montella's coming back. And actually, no, because from a Fiorentina point of view, he was so good in his last spell. And I think If he is ever to regain that reputation, why not try and do it at a club in which he's familiar? And to my mind, like his first season at Milan, when he had a lot of young players and that Milan didn't have any money to spend, he actually did really well with them. And it was only when the money came in that he started to struggle. So I think it is probably the right project for a coach like Montella, with all the young players that we've got. And certainly Pioli had not succeeded in finding their potential. They need some more, they need some improved players in midfield, and hopefully in the summer Corvino can supply them. And I think that he now has a run of a few games left at the end of this season. in order to really gauge what's needed in the summer, and that will give him a head start. And I think that might, you know, that might really help. So I'm pretty positive and pretty open to the idea of him coming back and doing a good job.
Okay, so let's close on outlook on one thing that has the potential to be very positive for Fiorentina and maybe one not so positive. So let's start with the positive. One of the reasons why some people thought Pioli might hang on was because Fiorentina is in the Coppa Italia semifinal. I hope you constantly rib our friend John Solano of how Fiorentina made it this far.
Oh, definitely.
So how confident do you feel about Fiorentina's chances in the Coppa Italia now?
Well, in the semifinal match is poised at 3-3 with Atalanta. I went to that first leg in Florence, and I have to say it was a brilliantly exciting end-to-end game. Neither team was really interested much in defending. It was just attack, attack. So I think now with... I'm not sure Pioli could have got them through because they're away now in the second leg and it's tied at 3-3. But I think with a fresh outlook and a fresh perspective, Montella could get them to the final. And if you think he must be coming into this role thinking, if I can get Fiorentina to win the Coppa Italia in my first season in charge, you know, how incredible would that be for the fans? And it would really get everybody on his side in a huge way. So I'm not sure. It's a kind of a 50-50. It could go either way because Atalanta are very they're a very experienced side at getting results. So certainly recently, and then they've either got the prospect of Lazio or Milan in the final. So it's going to be tough. But I think now there's a little bit of renewed optimism, and you know, let's hope that Montella can do the business.
Okay. Well, I hate to ask you since I know you have strong affection for this player, but we are in April and before you know it, it'll be that time of year again. How do you rate the chances of Chiesa staying at Fiorentina next season? You think there's enough going on positive at the club that he's going to want to stick around for at least one more season?
Earlier in the season, I was really, really confident that he was going to stay because he had a great relationship with Pioli. His father had said that he wanted to him to stay at Fiorentina and develop a little bit longer. I'm not sure now with the changes, but I think, you know, it's important to remember that his father is an ex-professional footballer. He's not from Florence, but he enrolled Federico in the Fiorentina Youth Academy at a very young age, and they've lived in Florence ever since. His brother is in the academy as well, his younger brother. And I think that, you know, it's not the same situation where with an ordinary player, perhaps his family isn't a wealthy family. You know, money is a big part of it. But I think, obviously, the Chiesa family are already wealthy. And I think his father has definitely got a very clear career plan for his son. And that will be monitored carefully. And he will be very aware not to make a big move too soon, because we've seen before with lots of footballers, if they go somewhere too soon, that their career goes downhill. So I think... If I was a gambling person, I had to say one way or the other, I think he will probably stay for one more year at least. You see, when Fiorentina celebrate gold and things like that, he's very passionate about the club, and he's obviously grown up there, so he feels attached to the club. I'm not saying that will keep him there forever, but I think it'll be very carefully decided when he makes that step up, and I don't think he's quite ready yet, because as much as people see clips on Twitter and things of him doing amazing things, if you watch 90 minutes of every game, he has still got a lot to learn. He doesn't always make the right decision, and he's definitely got room to develop.
Excellent. Well, Chloe, you don't have room to develop when it comes to covering Serie A and coming on the podcast. It's always a pleasure to have you on. So thanks so much for joining us. Everyone check out
Chloe's great articles and the show she does with our friends, Nima, John. Really, really great stuff. We really enjoy it. So thanks again for joining us today, Chloe.
Thanks, David. That was great.
All right. Awesome stuff. Great to hear from Chloe. Always great to have her on the pod. Great to read her stuff. And really good to hear about Fiorentina every once in a while, because for me, I honestly forget about them. So, David, what I don't forget about are awesome Twitter questions from our great listeners. So we got a bunch of good questions once again. So let's get to them, shall we? First question, David. If you had an absolute must-win game at hand, who would you trust more between Milan, Inter, Lazio, and Napoli?
What a question. John Lamorte, who sends us a lot of questions. This is a tough one. I put a lot of thought into it. So let's start with exclusion. I'm taking Lazio off right away. And you guys know I like a lot of Lazio's players. I have a soft spot for him, but I just can't trust them. This goes back to last season. I think even more so than Napoli, they really choked there at the end of the season, got out of the Champions League. It was there for the taking. This season, they've struggled, except for Inter, all the big matches, they haven't done well. So I'm taking them off the table right away. Inter, historically, the Pazza Inter thing, you just never know what Inter you're going to get. So I'm going to exclude them next. Milan's a little tough, you know. I like Gattuso. I like their defense is very, very solid. I feel like you have a base there. I'm not sure you can really call them choke artists. I just think Milan, you know, talent-wise, they're getting closer to the top three teams in Serie A. But I think Milan is kind of exactly where they're supposed to be in the standings. So it really comes down to them and Napoli. And look, I've said it a million times. I think way too much is made about Napoli supposedly choking last season, Serie A. When you get to that many points and not win the title, you're not a choker. We're not just giving enough credit to Juve. And yeah, I know the Higuain goal and losing the Scudetto in the hotel room and all that. But, you know, Napoli against Arsenal, not great either. I thought this season in the Champions League, they played very well. But, you know, they lost to Liverpool, but even more was like giving up that late goal to PSG in the match. And the first time they played in Paris. So I'm going to say I'm going to take Milan. It's close because I think Napoli has more talent. But I think with Napoli, you just never know exactly what you're going to get. I feel like with Milan, I know exactly what I'm going to get. So that's me. I'm curious to get your take, Alex. Anything that jumped out at you on that one?
You got to go with your gut, right? Who would I most trust between those teams to win one game? Napoli. Napoli. I have to say Napoli. And maybe it's the continuity of the team. Maybe it's the fact that Ancelotti is the manager and he has certainly been around. But David, it also might just be process of elimination. I might have just more chose that answer because of the teams I wouldn't trust in that scenario. So next Twitter question. What are the odds Inter bottle a Champions League spot? I don't mean to laugh. What are the odds, David?
For me, very low. And look, you know, both you and I picked Inter to finish second at the start of the season. You know, a little bit below those expectations. They're in solid position now. They have a pretty good, you know, lead over the fifth place team. I mean, they'd have to drop two spots, not one. At this point, I know a lot's made about Inter's remaining schedule. And the next match against Roma, that's huge. That's a huge match because Roma is it really comes down to two out of three teams between Roma, Inter, and Milan. So that's a huge match. And on paper, you could say that Inter's schedule the rest of the way is difficult. But they have Juve, and you look at their lineup against Spal. And if Juve passed this round, I think they're going to keep projecting, looking all to the Champions League. Napoli have really nothing to play for at this point. Chievo are already relegated. Empoli and Udinese are in the race to avoid relegation, but that's later on. Who knows? Maybe they're safer. And also, I don't think Inter's schedule is as bad as people made it out to be. I know that having Juve and Napoli jumps out, but those two games, those teams don't have much to play for. So I know the Pazza Inter thing, but I'm going to say it. I'd be shocked if Inter aren't in the Champions League next season.
All right, interesting Twitter question here. David, do you think it was unethical for Allegri to bench so many of his starters against Spal?
So it's a tough question, right? Because Allegri gets roasted when he doesn't rotate enough before Champions League matches. And in this match, he went all out, gave a debut, I think, two or three players, had a lot of bench guys out there. And, you know, to me, at the end of the day, a team has to do what's best for them. So I don't think, you know, if you look at it, Juve's perspective, there was nothing wrong with what they did there. And again, Bologna's coach, Mihailovic, was pretty incensed because Spal got 3 points, which against a Juve in top shape, they almost certainly wouldn't have gone. So I get that. But this journalist in Italy, Biazin, who covers Inter in Milano, is really, really outstanding. He made a really good point. He goes, okay, you can say what Juve did is bad, but what about all the other teams in Serie A who, with 7 matches to go, are so far behind Juve that they left Juve the opportunity to do this? So I think his perspective is important too. So yeah, I get it to a certain extent. But to me, Allegri can win with the rotation. And let's be honest, there's some people that will take any excuse to hammer Juve. And at the end of the day, they did what's best for them. So I don't have a huge problem with it.
All right. This next question, actually, many people don't know this. It's about one of my favorite Juventus players. David, how will you remember Andrea Barzagli?
So Barzagli announced that he's retiring at the end of the season. No surprise, he's barely played. So, I mean, a couple of things. I mean, I think Barzagli, out of the 3 players in the BBC, Bonucci, Chiellini, and Barzagli, he's the one that had the smallest profile for sure. Like, Chiellini is overall had the best career, no doubt about it. Juve captain, is having really a great season now at his age. Chiellini's definitely going to be remembered more. Bonucci, his passing, controversy and whatnot, he's a very public figure. I feel like Barzagli is kind of the quiet one on the side. But there was a stretch of 2-3 years where I think Barzagli was the best Italian defender, period. Chiellini was battling injuries. I just think Barzagli was incredibly solid. When I think of him, I think of his ability to read games, amazing positioning. I mean, not the fastest guy, tall guy, but, you know, not great on headers, but just his positioning and tactical intelligence. You know, some people might not know, he was a World Cup winner in 2006. He was a bench player on those Azzurri. And because of that, Del Piero actually recommended to Juve to buy Barzagli. And this was during the dark years after Calciopoli, when Juve was really struggling. Barzagli was playing in Germany. Juve got him for essentially nothing, like less than $500,000. And he ended up being one of their best players in this title run. So I think Del Piero, that was one of the best assists of his career. He gave Barzagli a new lease on life. Turned his career around and gave Juve a great member of 8 titles. So I'll remember him for that as well, but really a very, very good career. And I think he'll make a very good coach because of his ability to read a game.
All right, David, this is a very interesting question. How much of an impact will Juventus's pursuit of Joao Felix have on Paulo Dybala's future?
Yeah, so we've been writing a lot about it on Di Marzio's site, and even Fabrizio Romano had a report today. So Juve is all in on Joao Felix. They are the favorites to sign him right now. Really helps that they have Jorge Mendes, you know, Ronaldo's agent who brought him Cancelo. Really helps that they have Ronaldo, every Portuguese player, you know, of Joao Felix's age, kind of idolize him. He wants to play with him. So I think there's a pretty good chance he'll go to Juve. Now, granted, the price tag is exorbitant, $120 million is release clause. Personally, if you ask me, between João Felix and De Ligt, I would tell you Juve needs De Ligt a hell of a lot more than they need João Felix, because I think their attack's great as is, and they really could use defense. But this is definitely an outworldly talent. And for a variety of reasons, I definitely think this would have an impact on Dybala. Dybala struggling to play regularly now. So there's already that. Bernardeschi's had a great season. Then we add Moise Kean right now as well. You can only start 11 people at a time. So that's another offensive weapon where Juve stacked. And they also gave Mandzukic an extension. And obviously they would have to finance this move somehow. But I got to wonder, you know, how much has Dybala's transfer value been impacted? He's definitely had a very difficult season. I'm starting to think it's hard to really pinpoint what position is ideal for him. But, you know, he's 26, still a big name. You know, every time I tweet about João Félix, I inevitably get a ton of questions on Dybala. So, yeah, I mean, my God is if João Félix comes in, we can say pretty good odds Dybala leaves. Now, where could he go next? Real Madrid could make sense. You know, maybe part of the Ronaldo deal was like, hey, you know, if we ever move Dybala, you'll get first dibs. He's always kind of hinted that he wants to play in La Liga. He also hinted that he'd like to play at Barcelona and maybe the Premier League as well. It seems a lot of the Premier League fans are definitely really into it. So I'm very intrigued by this move by João Félix. And I think it's, you know, it's fantastic that Juve is really operating like a big, big club. But I got to wonder if they're just getting enamored too much with these offensive players when maybe they really need to look at their back line and another midfielder.
Yeah, David, I totally agree that Matthias De Ligt is the player they should go for first. But just imagine if they had Moise Kean and João Félix together. That would be, woo, that would be great now and one for the future. All right, next one. Do you think Hakim Ziyech could be a potential signing for a top Serie A team?
So he was heavily linked to Roma last season. And man, how much better off would they be had they signed him over Pastore? That deal's an absolute disaster. I mean, thank God they got Zaniolo, because if not, that whole Nainggolan and Roma replacing him with Pastore, what a disaster. But I got to wonder now that Monchi's gone, does this mean Roma isn't really in the mix there? So I'd be curious to see. I mean, maybe, you know, there is Monchi's right-hand man, Massara, still in the mix at Roma. And interestingly, he's traveling to Boston today to actually meet with Palotta. So we'll know more on the sporting, what will happen with the sporting director. So maybe if Massara gets the job, there'll be some continuity. If they bring someone completely external from the club, maybe they'll go for a completely different target. But I think he'd be a nice addition in Serie A. How do you think he'd fit in Serie A? Do you think he'd be a good addition?
Yeah, absolutely. But here's my thing with Hakim Ziyech is he's a tough one to positionally fit in some formation. So I think you really need to have the perfect system for Hakim Ziyech, because I like to say Hakim Ziyech's best position is no position. He's a roamer. He really is a roamer. And maybe it would be more of a 10, more of an advanced midfield role. So if you want him to play a wing, I think David Neres, the winger on Ajax, is a better fit if you want him to play the wing. But if you have a creative spot for him, and it's interesting you say Pastore, because Pastore is just supposed to be a creative midfielder. But if you do have a creative spot for Hakim Ziyech, he's a great signing, in my opinion. Absolutely. All right, David, we can't get away from these two. Do you think that the Bakayoko-Kessié situation is something the Italian Federation should be involved with?
Absolutely not. I mean, was it silly? Yeah. Was it immature? And again, you know, I've been following the sport for over 30 years. I can't really remember something similar. Like, I'm sure it's happened. But it was just silly. They all apologized. That Acerbi, I have to say, although his initial quote saying Lazio's better than Milan man-to-man, to me, ended up looking really good here. And I respect that Bakayoko at least admitted he was wrong multiple times. To me, it's really outrageous that this story is being talked about way more than the racist incidents that happened with Kane. And, you know, I hate the whataboutism and, you know, the defense to something is pointing to something worse. I really hate that stuff in so many walks of life. But this is really one of the things that jumps out at me. If there was so much vigor and desire to investigate what happened and reparations, this is not what's important. We've had far worse. And like I said, it even the fight between the players right before this was probably worse than this. So I get that it looks bad. It's a bad visual, but this is being way too much being made about it. And I think Italian football is like really looking quite silly again, because with something that was really important to address with passion and vigor, the Kane one, barely anything was done, but it feels like the world's ending over this. So the people involved resolve it. They're cool with it. So that's good enough for me.
Well said. If they got involved on this one, it would be like, where are your priorities? So staying on Bakayoko, has he been the best defensive midfielder in Serie A this season? And is he a must-buy for Milan?
So an interesting question. So, you know, I think I need to define what this position really is, defensive midfielder. Is it like a ball distribution or more someone that takes the ball back from the opponents and whatnot. I think Bakayoko's actually been a better passer than I imagined. It's kind of been surprising that he plays better with Kessié than, say, Bilha, because from the outside, you'd think he's more similar to Kessié than Bilha, but he's been pretty good too with ball distribution. So when I think of that role, he's definitely up there. I think Brozovic, definitely not imposing physically and defensively, but he is kind of the ball distribution guy from the back. There's Lucas Lleva on Lazio, who I think is probably the closest to Bakayoko. So he's there. De Rossi has been fantastic this season when healthy. Roma's so different when he's not there. And an underrated one is Frühler on Atalanta. Very good defensive midfielder. But look, Bakayoko started slow, had a little bit of a slump recently, but there was a stretch from like November to March where he was really one of, not regardless of position, one of the best players in Serie A. So I think you could say he's the best in that role. Now, is he a must-buy for Milan? In my opinion, yeah. I mean, Milan needs as many starters, caliber players, good enough to play on the top three, four teams in Serie A, and Bakayoko's clearly that. I think, you know, if they don't make the Champions League and they have to sell someone, I'd be open to selling Kessié before not redeeming Bakayoko, because Kessié is, you know, regardless of the jersey thing, there was the fight with Bilha. I don't know. If I had to keep one between Bakayoko and Kessié, for me, it's a no-brainer. But hopefully Milan makes the Champions League and they can keep both. But long and short of it, yeah, I think Milan needs to do whatever's necessary to keep Bakayoko. The ball's in their court. If they want to keep him, they can keep him. They just have to pay the money. He seems to love Milan. Like, the one positive that came out of this whole Acerbi mess is it's really obvious how much Bakayoko loves playing Milan. And I think in a way that's really pretty cool.
Yeah, and I joke about Bakayoko a lot, but truly, it really is nice when a player finds a place he's comfortable. And it was not a fun year for him last season, so I'm glad that he's having a lot more fun. So, next Twitter question. David, why are Lazio always the victim of VAR, and why is Dermisi still playing for them?
So, you guys know I don't like talking about referees, but the reason I included this question is I kind of find that ironic how, you know, Lazio loses this match controversially against Milan, and just before, Milan was complaining a lot about the referees and VAR and whatnot. So it always goes to show that, you know, with referees, A, you're never going to change anyone's mind on anything, which is why I really don't talk about it. And everyone's going to think there's a conspiracy against them. Now, Lazio, you know, hasn't, I could say that if you were a conspiracy theorist between last season, how it ended, and now, you definitely have some ammunition, but I remain of the opinion that it's really much more incompetence than conspiracy theories. As far as Dormisi, like, I didn't know anything about him before he arrived in Serie A. Lazio has a good track record of discovering these players on foreign teams that they buy for cheap money, but this wasn't a great year for Tare. Dormisi has done nothing. Even Berisha, who arrived from the Austrian league, hasn't done much. So not a great year transfer-wise for Lazio.
David, what was your reaction to Chievo finally getting relegated?
So I have a lot of thoughts on this. I was kind of not really surprised, but this is a constant. Like, how many fans of, like, top teams in Serie A hate Chievo? Like, I even had a journalist from Poland email me today saying, can you explain to me what this is? And, you know, it's kind of hard for me to say. Now, I know Chievo really represents, like, the stereotypes of boring defensive Italian football. Like, they are the epitome of Catenaccio, so I get that. Maybe it's their style of play. And they have been spoilers against a lot of teams. We know Pellissier scoring against Juve. They've had Roma's number. But I really find this hate on Chievo really bizarre to me. To me, it's like, picking, you know, if you're at school and there's a kid who comes from a very poor family, who's maybe not the smartest guy, but is really working so, so hard to keep up with his classmates and manages to do it. I find all the hatred on Chievo would be like bullying that kid. It's like, give me a break. For those that don't know, Chievo is the second team in Verona after Hellas Verona, who are a much bigger club. Although Hellas Verona have gone to Serie B many times, Chievo have been in Serie A for over 10 seasons straight. So for me, they deserve respect. They're not even really come from the city of Verona. They are from a small suburb outside Verona with less than 5,000 people. They don't have many resources financially, their own, by the makers of Pandoro, the famous Italian Christmas cake. So I don't know. I got to say, I find it really Bush League that people really pick on Chievo so much. But I get it that they are. They've been spoilers and the stereotype of defensive Catenaccio football. But I wish them well. And I think the fact that they were in Serie A for so long definitely deserves respect.
All right, David. I got to admit, I don't watch this show for really no reason. But when I went on Twitter last night, I felt like I was the only person in the world who does not watch this show. So the question is, do you still think The Wire is more interesting to watch than Game of Thrones?
Okay, so let's look at the wording. Do you still think The Wire is more interesting to watch than Game of Thrones? So the wording's really important. So, you know, look, I have to say I'm really not a fantasy, like Lord of the Rings type guy. I'm really not. Like, I really like, I like to say I'm a reality-based person. I'm not really into the fantasy world and whatnot. I didn't get into Game of Thrones till after the second or third season. And everyone's like, Dave, you have to watch it. I got into it with my wife. My wife loves the show. It's really well done. Like, I have to say, there's no buts about it. They put a lot of money into it. The scenery is incredible. Special effects are incredible. The fight scenes are incredible. I love the dragons. Like, I like to say, you know, I have a hard time keeping up with all the characters and all the storylines. I tune in more for the dragons, the fights, violence, the nudity, which is really good on the show. But it's definitely well done. It definitely keeps my attention. I'm definitely going to keep watching. But, you know, I'm a reality-based person. To me, The Wire is both really entertaining because the storylines are great, has great characters, but it really has such an incredible social commentary on America. And I think it's just becoming more and more important in this era now. So for me, the way it's worded, interesting, is kind of like, I find Game of Thrones probably more entertaining. I find The Wire more interesting because of what they're trying to say about society. I mean, it ultimately is comparing apples and oranges, but there's no doubt about it. Both are incredibly well done television shows.
All right, David, next Twitter question. Rank ZZ Top, Whitesnake, and Poison.
So I love you guys. You've sent so many pop culture questions. I had to spread them out because we got really a lot. You guys know that I love them, but we don't want to make you too much of that. This is a very interesting question. These are three, such a range of bands. So kudos to the person that sent it. I don't know. I'm assuming he's a fan of all three. So if I'm going to rank them, I'm not a big Whitesnake guy. So I'm going to go ZZ Top, Poison, Whitesnake for very different reasons. Like, I think ZZ Top's one of the most underrated bands out there. They've been around for 50 years. I kind of think they're in a lot of ways the American version of AC/DC. Their guitar player, Billy Gibbons, you never hear him mentioned among the best guitar players ever, but he's absolutely there. In my mind, just an incredible band. They've sold over 50 million records too, dating back. They've been around 50 years, so for good reason. I'm actually going to see them in September. Can't wait. Like, Whitesnake is kind of like all-star metal band, hard rock band with David Coverdale, who used to be from Deep Purple, with a cast of a lot of different musicians and a lot of really good musicians. I'm not a huge fan of theirs, but I definitely appreciate how good they are at their craft. David Coverdale was also in a band briefly with Jimmy Page. Like, he's kind of a Robert Plant clone, and he has great musician. If you like hard rock, like classic rock, like, they're a great band. And Poison, look, you know, unlike Whitesnake, terrible musicians, really corny. To me, they are the epitome of a hair metal band, you know, all, you know, smoke, no fire, all about appearance and whatnot. Like, yeah, they have some good songs. They really represent an era, but, you know, I kind of enjoy them for what they are. I mean, I definitely wouldn't compare them to Whitesnake as far as craftsmanship and ability as musician, but if I had to listen to a band for an afternoon, I would take them over Whitesnake.
All right, David, how about this? If you could interview Thom Yorke, what would you ask him?
So this gentleman sent me a couple of questions and I changed it a little bit because the other band he asked me about, a Porcupine, I think. I'm not that familiar with it, so my apologies. So if I could interview Thom Yorke, like, let me tell you, I'm a total Radiohead groupie. Every time they come to Boston, I do try to stay outside the hotel to see if I'll bump into them. Never happened yet. If I were to interview Thom Yorke, the one question I'd ask him is, when did he figure out he had such an amazing voice and how did it happen? I've read almost every interview he's done. I don't think anyone's asked him, and I'd be very fascinated by this. Was I remember Chris Cornell talking about how he was a kid and he was taking music lessons, I think the piano, and he was just singing along and his music teacher was like, time out. You have an amazing voice. And he went to his parents and they're like, forget the piano. Your son needs to be a singer. But I think it was the style of music that he does is a very powerful voice. Thom Yorke is really his falsetto, is his trademark. So I'd be really curious to know when Thom Yorke found out he had a great voice. Was it someone else that picked up on it or whatnot? Like, I think his voice has aged really incredibly well. Like, he's now in his 50s. He sounds just as good, if not better, than when they first came out. So that's what I would ask him. So before we get to our next guest, I just wanted to thank you guys for your support. There's been a great new phase of Cultureland. Alex did a lot of work to get us on a new platform. We're really tracking the amount of listens that we get. So we appreciate your support. Please keep telling your friends about the podcast. The reviews on iTunes, those go a long way towards helping us. And, you know, I read them all. I also wanted to point out that while we keep Cultureland free to everyone because we want to keep growing, we just did extra questions for patron listeners. We are going to have a lot of extra content there. I'm also going to have our friend Enrico Passarella Guardaline, who we had on talking about the relegation race, write some articles on, you know, lower table players, maybe some things that aren't covered as much in other places. So we're trying to do a lot of other content on our Patreon page. We appreciate your support. We have different tiers, $3, $7, even more. If you feel generous and want more content or want support with your own projects. I also want to say that for the month of April, we are going to donate all of the proceeds from Patreon. And I'm not saying profit. I'm saying every penny we raise to this nonprofit in Italy called Insuperabili. It's a great onlus, as we would call it in Italy, a nonprofit organization that creates football academies and runs football academies for people with disabilities, mainly kids, but also adults. And I think it's great that they use football to help these people. So if you're interested, you'll be doing a good cause. You'll also be supporting Cultureland long term. But I think this will be a nice initiative for us to support really a great organization. But without further ado, let's get to our next guest who I've been wanting to have on Cultureland for a very long time.
So I am very excited to welcome our next guest. We've had a run of a lot of great returning guests recently, including one of his colleagues, Paolo Condò of Gazzetta dello Sport. And I've been following our next guest, Alex Frosio, who is a journalist at Gazzetta dello Sport for quite some time on Twitter. He has some really astute observations on calcio. He's a match reporter at Gazzetta dello Sport, which for those of you that don't know, really is the Bible of Italian sports. I still read it every day. It's a daily paper. And he also does the pagelle, so the grades of the players on matches, which nowadays in the era of fantacalcio is a very big responsibility. So, Alex, it's a real pleasure to have you. Benvenuto a Cultureland.
Thank you, David. It's an honor for me to can talk to your podcast.
Terrific. So, Alex, since it's your first time on the show, I kind of want to go a little bit around Serie A. And as I mentioned, you have some very astute observations on the league. So we're recording this right after the Spal-Juve match. Juve didn't clinch the title, but it really is just a matter of time now. So Juve's been on a great streak dating back to when Antonio Conte arrived. They've had two teams that went to the Champions League final. They had record-breaking seasons with points, but now, of course, they have Ronaldo. And this is a star-studded Juve. So, Alex, tell me, where do you rank this current Juve compared to the ones we've had in the past 8 years?
Well, this is probably, I think, the best Juventus compared to the other seven. Maybe one of the best Juventus teams of all time. I think that the team that reached the Champions League final back in 2015 had a better midfield because they had the Maestro Pirlo, Pogba, Vidal, Marchisio. But if we talk about the roster, the depth of the roster, how many different choices Allegri can make to change the pace of the game or to gain a better control, well, you can compare this Juventus to any other. And obviously, Juventus now has Cristiano Ronaldo, which is one of the two best players in the world, maybe the best player in the world when we talk about scoring goals and be decisive in a match.
Okay, so this is one thing that I read often on your Twitter account, which is very interesting. Obviously, as you mentioned, this is a great team, Juve, no matter how you slice it, not just in their history and said, yeah, they are one of the best teams in the world right now. But this season, I mean, there really is a massive gap in points. I saw during the first half today of the match, you even tweeted that Juve has, you know, just a couple of starters, a lot of young players, and they're dominating, you know, Spal, who is in the relegation race, but they are a Serie A team with all their best players. So do you see this massive gap as a more sign of Juve's greatness or maybe a lack of quality on the other teams in Serie A?
Yeah, for all this is the reason I said Juventus is great and they deserve all the points they have. But yes, I think that the other teams were not good enough. And I'm talking about a lack of quality because all other teams didn't make steps forward year by year. And I'm talking about also a lack of hard training too. Because when Antonio Conte won the first Scudetto on the streak, his team's main opponent was AC Milan, and AC Milan had Ibrahimovic, Thiago Silva, Nesta, Seedorf. It was a great team. AC Milan was stronger, no doubt about that. But Juventus at that time was physically and mentally stronger, very well trained, and they could compete and beat AC Milan that year. And I think that too many times this year, only in the past years, Juventus won games simply walking too easily. And today there's only one team that is properly trained, in my opinion, and that is Atalanta. And in fact, Atalanta destroyed Juventus in Coppa Italia because they run, because they're physically strong. Too many times this year we saw Juventus be very slow, just they could win matches only because they are Juventus. And if you don't run enough and you're not good enough, you can't beat Juventus. So that's why I say that there's too much gap between Juventus and other teams.
So now let's talk about the main competitors for Juventus, starting with Napoli, who last season really gave Juve a big run for their money. And, you know, of course, that was Maurizio Sarri's Napoli, which I know you're a big fan of Sarri,
yes, I am.
And, you know, Carlo Ancelotti came in. In Serie A, obviously, the team's not doing as well. The match against Arsenal was rather disappointing in the first leg. Let's see what happens next week. But let me ask you, how different would you say Ancelotti's Napoli is compared to what we saw from Sarri's during his years at Napoli?
Yeah, Sarri's Napoli was, in a way, a very predictable team because, you know, you knew that how they played. You knew that they overloaded the left flank and then find Callejon on the right side. But they did it with perfect time because Sarri's Napoli was a perfect mechanism due to the fact that there was almost no turnover. This is a big difference between Napoli's Sarri and Ancelotti's Napoli because Ancelotti did use many players and Sarri didn't. But Sarri's team had pace, made pressure in the opposite half, one-touch passes. You don't see this anymore. Ancelotti's Napoli is, in my opinion, a slower team, still with great quality, yes, but I see much more improvisation up front. Ancelotti gives more freedom to his attacking players, but I'm afraid it's not enough. And in fact, they're 20 points away from Juventus. Sarri took the best from his players, also mentally. This Napoli seems unable to concentrate on every single match.
Interesting. So now let's talk about Milan. And, you know, I've been following mm-hmm. you for a while, and I always liked reading your observations on Milan's managers. And as you mentioned, this is not the Milan that when Allegri was there with Ibrahimovic and all that quality. And I remember some of your observations on, like, the warm-ups with Mihailovic and whatnot. So I'm curious to get your take on Gattuso. And so let me ask mm-hmm. you this way. How different, maybe better, would Milan be if they had an experienced, established manager, unlike someone like Gattuso, who, as your friend Paolo Condal said, you know, is a young manager who's kind of learning on the fly? How different would Milan look with a more known quantity as a manager, in your opinion?
Yeah, this is not a simple question, let me tell you, because Gattuso, in my opinion, builds a very good defensive system, which is the key to the results he's getting. But in my opinion, it didn't work enough, or he didn't work properly on the attack. His style of playing is not entertaining because, in my opinion, when you see AC Milan play, you don't see what they can do when they have the ball. And one of the main issues, in my opinion, is when you play with two wingers like Suso and Calhanoglu, they never get into the penalty area. There's always just one man or two men in the penalty area. They never go there. I'm talking about Suso and Calhanoglu. This is not enough. You have to take many players in the penalty area. That's not what AC Milan does, in my opinion. Say that, I don't know how many other managers would have given something more to this team. Because I think there are only two or three managers who can add something to their team. Now in Italy, I'm talking about maybe Giampaolo, maybe Di Francesco, and for sure Gasperini, Atalanta's manager, who took a team with not with great players, but the way they play, they can get very good results. They have the best attack in Italy. So Gasperini is someone who can add something to the team. I don't know how many other managers can do that.
So let me ask you about Gasperini, as you mentioned him twice already. You know, he had a yeah. very brief experience at Inter. In U.S. sports, we'd call him getting a cup of coffee there and leaving. He's been brilliant at Atalanta. Do you think he would be good at a top team again? You know, at Inter, we've seen a lot of managers struggle. Do you think, like, you for a team like Milan or Roma, would you like to see him take a chance on Gasperini?
I do. I do because I think he changed a little bit since he was in Inter. He now has the credibility. He can be considered a top manager right now in Italy. He needs players who adapt to his system, who can sacrifice for the team. That's not what usually top teams do, but if you find players who can do that, I would like to see Gasperini in a top team. Yes, he can do something very good, in my opinion.
Okay, so now let's talk about Inter. And, you know, in my opinion, you know, Juve's one is going to win for the eighth time. They clearly are dominating Serie A. If I had to pick one team that I think has the best chance for a variety of reasons to compete with Juve at some point, maybe next season already, it would be Inter. Mm-hmm. So I want to know if you agree with that, if you see someone else that has maybe a better chance. And what do you think Inter needs to reach the next level to get closer to Juve?
Well, right now, Inter is unpredictable. Will they sell Icardi in the summer? Who will be the next manager? That's important to know. And I think that if they hire Antonio Conte, for example, they can be a Scudetto contender for sure. for what I said in the beginning, that Conte can take the best out from players, even if they're not the best on the market. So to make a step forward, by the way, I think that Inter needs, first of all, a cerebral in midfield. Because last year we saw Rafinha, there was a big head, and it was only Rafinha, if you know what I mean. And yeah. Without him, they lost control in the midfield. They didn't find a solution. So I think that they need something like that. I also need that they would need a winger with 10, 15 goals in his feet. Maybe a couple of fullbacks, mm-hmm. because they don't have great quality there. I think they're still very far from Juventus, but all the teams right now are very far from Juventus. I think that to fill in that gap will take more than a year.
So let's talk about one of the big stars of this Serie A season and someone that Inter gave up on to get Nainggolan, and this is Nicolò Zaniolo. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, what do you make of Zaniolo? Do you think he's legit? Do you see him as becoming a really big star, maybe the Italian version of Pogba, something along those lines? Or do you think maybe this is kind of a flash in the pan?
No, I think Zaniolo is a fantastic player. He has everything. He's a skilled player. He can play in many positions. He's modern. You know, Di Biagio, the manager of Under 21 national team, said he's not Italian. He's German for what he is. And I think he's an excellent player. But I think that Di Francesco must be acknowledged for his development, because he gave him the opportunity to play. And this is uncommon in a conservative tournament like Serie A. And in this way, Zaniolo got self-confidence, which is what a young player needs. And I think that's very, very, very important. We had many young players who can be considered good, but they don't play enough.
Yeah.
And Di Francesco made him play. And that's a very big difference. Let's see what's going on with Moise Kean.
Yeah,
it's the same. He got space. He can score goals. He can play in a big team like Juventus. He's only 19 years old, but you can't say he's 19 years old because he plays like a big player. You know.
Yeah.
So you have to make them play, and we have this thing that in Italy, young players must be. You know, they don't have to play or play just a little bit. No, if they're good, they have to play. And that's what happened with Zaniolo.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Mancini created his own luck in a way, selecting him even before he had made his debut. And it's a good shout on Di Francesco, because I feel he's been criticized a lot this season, and you really never hear him getting credit for Zaniolo. So you mentioned Kane as well. Are there any other Italian players, young ones, or even non-Italian players, young players in Serie A that excite you beyond these two?
Well, everybody knows, I think, Chiesa and Barella and Mancini, who is a very good defender of Atalanta.
Yeah.
I think the next big thing will be Sandro Tonali. Now he plays in Brescia, in Serie B, but he's an excellent playmaker. And as Di Biagio again said, he said he plays like he's 40 years old, because mm-hmm. he's 18 or 19, but he has a great mind. Somebody says he looks like Pirlo, but he's a little bit different from Pirlo. He looks like him.
Yeah.
But as a style of play, he's more like Gattuso and Pirlo together. So I think we'll see him next year in Serie A, and he will be a very good head for... I don't know if he will play again in Brescia or in another good team, big team. I think that he can be a star next year.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like Brescia, if they come up to Serie A, would be great if he can play one season there. Maybe a club buys him and just leaves him there. So, Alex, you really have a great insight. So, on our podcast, we like with first-time guests to talk not just calcio, but also talk a little bit about your career. A lot of our listeners are bloggers, podcasters, people that are trying to break into the business. So as I mentioned, you know, Gazzetta dello Sport is the sports institution for journalism in Italy. So tell me a little bit, how did you get started in calcio journalism? How did it all begin for you?
Actually, this is a very long story, but I began in 1994 in a football magazine, a very technical football magazine, which is called Il Nuovo Calcio. It's the favorite magazine of managers and players because it's very, very, very technical. Anyway, my father was a football player and then a manager himself. So I've always been into football, and I watched it and studied it since I can say I was born. So
yeah,
so it's my life, let's say. I'm in football since I was born. I worked for many newspapers, for news agency, for TV, had many experiences. So then back in 2007, I joined Gazzetta. And what I do and what I always did is to study football, actually. Mm-hmm. Try to understand what happens on a football pitch. And that's what is important, in my opinion, in our job, in my job especially. I'm 45 now. I don't know if I can give any advice to a young writer, because I don't know. It seems to me that the world is going very fast. So
yeah,
there will be new ways to report football that I can probably imagine. So my only advice is to study, to read a lot, to find someone you trust and try to learn from him. And that's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
So let me ask you this final question, since you told me that you do the pagelle. So for those of you that don't know, in Gazzetta dello Sport, after each game, they give out grades to every player. It's very controversial with Fantacalcio and all. So tell me a little bit, what are the things that you keep in mind when you have to grade a player during a game? Does it matter so much if they score, if they make a mistake on something that creates a goal? So tell me a little bit, what are the things that you think about when you give out a grade to a player?
Yeah, my first sight is if they were involved in decisive actions, or if they score, if they give an assist, or they make a mistake, if they are a defender. That's what I see. Obviously, this is when you give a rating, that's very important. But I try to see what they do on the pitch, which are their duties, if they do what they are supposed to do, if they, I don't know if you know, let's make a name, Dybala. I know I can expect a lot from Dybala. If he doesn't do enough, he will get a bad rating, because I know he can do a lot. So it depends also on the kind of player you are trying to judge. I always look at the statistics, because they give you a view that you maybe didn't see, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Sometimes when you have to judge your player ratings to 22 or 26 players, sometimes one of them or two of them, you didn't see them a lot. So the numbers can help you. And that's it. That's it. And you always go wrong in something. There will always be someone who says, no, he didn't play like that. You misjudged him. But, you know, you try to do your best.
Absolutely. Well, Alex, it was a real pleasure to welcome you on. I can tell you your professoressa d'inglese, if she's listening, is very proud of you. You did a great with English. Your cultural knowledge is second to none. So it was a real pleasure to have you on Cultureland, and I'd love to have you back in the near future.
Thank you. When you want, whenever you want.
That's the show for today. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to everyone who sent in a question. As you guys know, we record a lot of these. So if you have another question on Serie A, transfers, TV, music, film, please send it in using the CalcioLand hashtag. And if you enjoyed the show, this is a free show available to all. Please leave us a review on iTunes. It takes 2 seconds to leave us a 5-star rating. If you leave a comment, Alex and I read them all. And these testimonials are great because they are from our listeners. They help us attract a bigger audience. And if you like all the content on the CalcioLand podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon. We have various tiers for you just to listen enhanced version of the podcast. We have a tier where you can read a lot of original blogs from me. We'll have Alex once in a while do a video, and I answer a lot of questions there. I think that'll be a lot of fun year-round, and especially during the transfer window. So thank you very much for the support, and we look forward to chatting with you in the next few days.